So I have a juniper bonsai. What does that say about my personality or my ego?
I think juniper bonsai are one of the more timeless species, and there's a reason they're one of the most popular and kind of the stereotype for bonsai. And it's mainly because a very old juniper can have a dead piece of trunk and a live piece of trunk that intertwine, right? And when they have that dead wood, live wood combination, it signifies like overcoming torment or strife or hardship or adversity, and also being able to thrive afterwards. And so bonsai kind of got its start with junipers in China, we think. We don't really know.
Yeah. Just because of how hardy they are.
Well, they're universally appealing because they're a nice dark green color and they don't drop their foliage, so they're consistent. And so a lot of people also pick the species they work with based on the characteristics of that species. So like behind me, I have a waste bark pine. This is one of my favorite species to work with, but it's not very popular. I like it because bark pops off and it does stuff. Most conifers just sort of sit there, and junipers are like a nice stabilizing force. And so you probably chose a juniper because it was readily available and because you identified with something in
there.
Astrology reading, but for bonsai.
Yeah.
You're listening to the TripSitter podcast, where we demystify substances, break down the science behind them, and discuss the crazy world of psychedelic culture. Like having a TripSitter watch over your experience, our goal is to provide guidance and support in preparation for your psychedelic journey. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy the trip.
I'm Justin. I'm the founder, editor-in-chief of TripSitter.
I'm Rowan. I'm a contributor for TripSitter.
And I'm James. I'm also a contributor for TripSitter. Joining us today is someone I met 2 years ago. He's the first person I've ever heard of who's made a career out of doing bonsai. He has an incredible story and he's an incredible person. I'm excited that he's here today with us to talk a little bit about his journey to committing his life to plants. So joining us today is Owen. And if you want to just kind of give us a little bit of background on your life and what you do and
sure.
Just kind of from a high level.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Basically, what I've been doing for about the last 20 years is studying plants in different genres of what they call ornamental horticulture, also with bonsai, garden design, and also endangered plant research, all sorts of different things. And I basically bounced around. When I was in high school, I got really affected by my grandfather. He was gardening 10, 12 hours a day, giving away produce that he made, giving away plants that he grew from seed. He was just doing all sorts of stuff, and he got a lot out of it, and it really affected me. And so when I decided to pick what I was going to do in college, I thought I was going to do landscape architecture at University of Georgia. And I found out that that was equivalent of being an AutoCAD drawer, and you just sit there and scrawl away in a dark office. And I like being outside, and it really helps my whole mental state to be outside just in general. When I was a lot younger, I would escape outside and get lost in the hedges and the woods around my parents' house in North Carolina. And that was where I felt more comfortable. And to this day, I still feel more comfortable outside. Fluorescent lighting affects me in a way that makes me very unhappy to exist in that space.
Yeah, I think it affects us all in that way.
Yeah. But like, I'm just like, it's kind of like bad country music, you know, like if I'm around it for a little too long, it's like nails on chalkboards and I'm like, I'm out. Have a nice day. So all that to say, I ended up getting into Japanese gardens and bonsai when I was my freshman in college. So I was taking an introductory to horticulture course. One of my friends pulled out a book called the Kokofuten, which is the national bonsai exhibition in Japan, which has been going on since about 20s, I believe. Mm. And I saw the book and I was like, holy crap, this is nature encapsulated into a tiny shape and it's infinitely more complicated than anything else I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And so I was hooked immediately to bonsai. Yeah. I studied horticulture there and my whole bent towards working with plants was I get to be outside and I get to interact with nature in a way that could potentially be productive instead of just consuming.
Yeah. Could you speak to some of those complexities that you just mentioned?
For bonsai? Yeah, sure. So basically most bonsai are between 4 feet and 1 foot tall. And so it's like this one in front of us here is a rare type of Japanese maple that has rough bark. And a tree like this can stay this size for 50, 100 years. So the complexity of bonsai is you're taking the notion of nature and then you're compacting it and it's transportable, it's shareable, and it's also available in a tight space. So it's like a travel nature, you know, travel, your travel nature bag. But my teacher, Keiichi Fujikawa, who's based in Osaka, Japan, basically said that I said, I want to go see the fall color in Kyoto, okay, which is where the most famous fall color Japanese maple places are. It's north of Kyoto in a town called Ohara, as well as a few others. So he said, why would I have to go there? I have this bonsai tree. Now, granted, he had some of the nicest Japanese maple bonsai that have ever been made in Japan in his nursery where I studied. And he wasn't wrong in that regard. However, he could go there in his head just by appreciating a bonsai tree. So that's part of the complexity of bonsai is what it actually is. Because most people just think it's a house plant.
Mm, yeah. And I know that there's also like a lot of intricate rules to each plant, especially when you're dealing with more rare or exotic plants. Can you talk about some of the knowledge that you have on some of these?
Okay, so for each species of plant, they have their own parameters that work best for making them a bonsai and also sustaining them. And sustainability is the actual most important part because you're trying to hold them in time at a certain stage of development and keep them there, right? And so the techniques for bonsai are basically from study of plants. So think about it like in China, Japan, and elsewhere in Asia, they watched these native plants because, you know, most bonsai that are popular in American culture as well as in Europe and elsewhere are Japanese native species. Mm-hmm. So this is essentially the exact same as our native red maple, Acer rubrum, right? Mm-hmm. And so they watched this plant, and I'm talking about daily. They studied the plant daily, and they said, if I pull this leaf off, what happens? Mm-hmm. Well, the leaves get smaller. And they figured that out. And then they documented it and they shared it. And the apprenticeship programs in Japan distributed that information to the people. And then they would in tune do a la carte services for customers or teach them. It just depended on the scenario. But with the complexities of plants, as they age, they also become kind of like older people. They get more finicky. They get tired easier. Mm-hmm. They can't produce 1,000 flowers for 100 years straight inside of a container. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the techniques that I learned in Japan are actually for how to keep them healthy, not necessarily the creation of the style. Now, I know how to do that too, but it all comes back to understanding the behavior of the plants. So for example, Japanese maples have sets of two leaves, right? Mm-hmm. So they're always going to grow in we call it bifurcation. Mm-hmm. So if you have sets of two and you multiply those sets of two, you can build the canopy of a tree, right? Well, because they grow in sets of two, that also means they're going to be very like static looking and rigid, you know, like a zipper, and it's very symmetrical. So we actually prune them to make them not look that way so that the scale is different and stuff like that.
Oh, interesting.
That's fascinating. So I was going to ask, like, how do you get the leaves to be so small in bonsais? Because I've seen a lot of maple trees growing up in Canada, and the leaves are much bigger than the same species that I've seen in bonsai form. So you're saying just by simply cutting the leaves, they come back smaller? How does that work?
That's definitely part of it. You can see like in the shot here, these leaves are smaller than the leaves on the top. And so these are acting as solar panels and they're absorbing light and creating energy. And they're on the top, so they don't have any competition. Anything down here is weaker. And with bonsai trees, we actually don't want this super vigorous top growth. We want it to be completely balanced throughout.
Right.
If you had to know one principle to understand bonsai, it's that we're balancing the vigor of the root system with the vigor of the top half above ground. And as long as the root system isn't coarse and fibrous, like if this thing had roots like my hand, then it would have giant shoots, right? But because we're cutting off all of the big roots and leaving only the fibrous tiny ones, we're moderating the energy and balancing the energy that's created from under the soil. And we're balancing that with the quantity of foliage and branching up here. And what happens is eventually the leaves get smaller and smaller because they don't need big leaves to function. They don't need that canopy because their root system is so happy in a bonsai pot that it generates smaller foliage and it's happy to stay that way.
Is it sort of like it doesn't have the root mass to sustain that much leaf like surface area, or is that kind of the idea?
Yes and no. So like if this canopy was this big and the pot was really tiny like it is now, it wouldn't be able to support the water needed to create that canopy, okay?
Right.
And so what's happening is we're prompting the tree to do things. We're not making it do stuff. Mm. Well, some people do. Some people exert their ego on the trees and just bend shit and do stuff and, you know, whatever. That's fine. But my practice for bonsai is a lot more, I don't think passive is the right word, but I'm much more interested in keeping the tree healthy and not forcing my ego on it. So if we put this tree in a 55-gallon nursery container or a drum, it would get 30 feet tall and 25 feet wide, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the tree understands its environment kind of like a rock outcropping or like a pocket in the side of a mountain, and it is very comfortable existing in this space. And so the trees actually enjoy the treatments they get and they're pampered, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like we're attentive, we're watching them. So
they
get smaller leaves compared to the ones in nature, just based on the roots mainly though.
You mentioned like imposing ego onto the tree or listening to the tree, this kind of like binary of how people relate to bonsai.
Okay.
Could you kind of like speak to how you've seen that like manifested in your time working with bonsai, and as someone who like is really bad at growing plants, like what does it mean to like listen to it and have it be sustainable in this way?
Gotcha. So I traveled and taught for about a decade on the road nationally and internationally, and I worked in private and public bonsai collections. But when I work in a private collection, I would go to someone's house usually actually, or their place of business and work on their trees. But people do bonsai kind of like how they pick pets. So if you have a golden retriever, happy-go-lucky human, right? Mm-hmm. Or at least open-minded and chill. If you have a chihuahua, you're probably high-strung and, you know, anxiety-ridden, right? So people choose specific bonsai based on their ego. Generally, it was what they're trying to achieve or what they have achieved. And everybody's a little different, right? And so people with inferiority complexes would have really big bonsai. And people with smaller trees that were more intricate and detailed were often more of a, I'm not going to use the word controlling type, but their personality allowed for working with minutia and getting their, you know, fix for bonsai out of manipulating smaller trees and sustaining them into a much tighter space. But mainly the ego that I saw in American bonsai culture was the bad kind. It was people buying trees to appear cultured and then killing the trees. To do bonsai at a high level, you have to be committed to care for these trees daily or indefinitely. And that's kind of a daunting task. And so some people would buy bonsai in order to appear diligent and balanced. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like they wanted people to come over and they wanted to talk about their trees.
Yeah. Well, it's like if someone comes over and this is on my table, that's dope, right? I'm going to look awesome. But it's like, that doesn't necessarily mean I'm taking care of it.
Right.
Yeah.
It can be a problem. And that's one of the things I was hired to do is I was hired to go and make sure they didn't screw up their trees. So I was like an art curator, but the medium is alive and it can devalue very fast.
Yeah. Well, and you had mentioned something to me off mic before we got started about how bonsai might have also gotten its start from people essentially rappelling down the mountain and collecting these kinds of trees that had naturally grown in those kind of harsher environments. Tell me a little bit about the environment that you do create for bonsai and how it does try to mimic that.
Okay, so kind of felt like a couple of questions, so I'll try to separate it. It's a universally accepted term called Yamadori. And Yamadori, because it means mountain road, is from the original bonsai collectors would risk their life scaling these ultra steep granite outcroppings in central Japan, and they would harvest these trees. And the Yamadori term comes from the fact that as they came down the mountain, the further down the mountain they got, the more expensive the tree got. Because they had just risked their life.
Yeah.
They don't know if the tree's going to make it or not. And it's really bad taste to ask if it has roots or not. It's very Japanese, right? You can't be like, did you just risk your life for a tree that's dead?
Yeah.
You just bought it and, you know, rolled the dice, right?
Right.
So Yamadori trees are what started bonsai because they were already dwarfed and that environment caused them to be a natural bonsai. And so there's two types of bonsai. There are those that are created like this from a cutting or a seedling. And then there's those that are wild collected. And wild collected trees are always more valuable because humans didn't manipulate them.
Yeah.
At least the majority of it.
Mm. And then how does this kind of mimic the environment of the rock outcropping?
Gotcha. So this container, because of its scale, is directly proportional to the height of the tree design. And it's also historically the amount of soil volume that's needed to sustain something this big, right? And so what we're doing is we are monitoring and observing what happens in nature. And then we're using these observations to apply as techniques.
Yeah.
And earlier you mentioned bonsai rules. And that's a really hot button issue among most people who don't know much about bonsai, right? So they go, oh, there's rules. There's these books and you got to do it. But that's the exact opposite of my opinion. I think that there are aesthetic principles that are universal throughout art and nature, and they apply to the bonsai. And by observing artistic, you know, scale and form and texture and those kind of things, you can do bonsai without ever reading a book.
Yeah.
I mean, you just look outside, you know, your trees and emulate that.
Yeah.
But there are techniques that have been time tested and proven that you can learn. And those using aesthetic principles and proven techniques, you can really make cool bonsai.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You are just so incredibly grounded. And like, I feel like I'm meditating while we're having this conversation. Yes, I'm so deeply mindful. I wanted to ask, you're talking about this experience of like listening to the bonsai and mimicking nature, but like this is a process that you've had to learn yourself as you've gone through. You said you've had teachers as well.
Right.
Can you speak to some of the like more challenging moments that you've had with these bonsai that haven't been as grounded and earthly and peaceful?
Sure. That's a wonderful question. So as a bonsai professional, you are not achieving horticultural therapy with your interaction with bonsai. It's quite the opposite, really, right? So you're there to help other people enjoy their hobby. Because bonsai is not a team sport, right? It's an introspective art form. You share your work because you love people or you want to transmit this, you know, cultural piece and share it because you're excited about it. But like bonsai can be very difficult. And part of being good at bonsai is the failure, right? So you get a tree, you go to a garden center, you rip all the roots off, you cut all the branches off, you put a bunch of wire, then you leave it outside, not not knowing that it needs to be watered, right?
Yeah. Hmm.
And then you kill your first tree.
Yeah.
Well, the people who are serious about bonsai have had many, many bonsai fatalities.
Yeah.
And they're learning through trial and error. Or if they hire a professional like me, I speed up process exponentially, right? Mm. I'm like, never do that. And they're like, okay, never do that. Got it. And then I say, text me, you know, it's September. Can I do this technique on my Japanese maple? And if they ask me and I tell them that's a good idea or not, they save themselves years, right?
Yeah.
And so my job as a bonsai professional was to make sure that people didn't screw up these ancient living beings, especially the really old imported ones from, say, Japan that were given to the National Bonsai and Pinjing Museum in DC or any other culturally important trees that are in the United States. You know, I would work on those because, like I was talking with you about earlier, the older trees get finicky.
Yeah.
And most people in America have no idea. Mm. Okay, so you got a Japanese maple that's this old. Sure, you can read a book and fix it. But what if it's 100?
Mm-hmm.
You can't just like bend a branch or cut off a whole section. The whole tree might,
right?
Yeah, that's what I did. And the trying parts of bonsai are first and foremost doing an apprenticeship, right? So basically I did a traditional art apprenticeship in Osaka for 2 years straight, worked about 100 hours a week. I got a day off a month. I had no money. I had no social life. I was basically a bonsai monk, right?
Yeah.
So we jammed 100 years worth of bonsai experience into a couple of years. And then I had metrics that I had to achieve in terms of how good I got at it, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, it'll pop your head. Like it'll literally make you have a breakdown.
What were those metrics?
The metrics were appreciation of aesthetics, understanding Japanese culture, learning Japanese while not being able to have time to study it, being able to appreciate complex artistic principles, having no background in it. I mean, I studied bonsai for a decade before I went there, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought I was pretty good.
Yeah, no, that had to be humbling.
Yeah. And then I went in 2009 to meet with these people and see which bonsai garden I could do my apprenticeship at. And while I was there, I was looking around at the trees and I was like, damn, I really suck at bonsai. And I could learn a lot here, right? And so I came back from that evaluation process, the first of many, in order to become an apprentice. And I threw away 75% of my trees.
Wow.
I was like, I can't keep them.
Wow.
These are not good enough. They never will be.
Yeah.
And so the trials and tribulations of bonsai as art form, being an implementer of it in America, was 10 times worse than my experiences in Japan, because at least there, they understood the process of apprenticeship and they knew what I was going to deal with.
Yeah.
Because my teacher did it, right? So he was enforcing a strict protocol on me having done it.
Mm-hmm.
But here, nobody has any idea about art apprenticeships in Japan.
Yeah.
They don't understand anything about what goes into that. And so they just think, I like bonsai and I get paid sometimes, right?
Yeah. Well, and one of your bonsais can be financially devastating too.
Yeah.
Like they can be worth a lot of money. And a lot of times, even like if you're buying a really cool starter bonsai, that's like a rare plant, that can be a lot of money. And then it's like before all of the time investment that you're going to have put into it too.
Right.
Are there any specific times you can think of that maybe you had done something and lost one of your bonsai plants and you just think like, that's a valuable lesson, but I can't believe that that happened.
That's a great question. So I have sort of a detachment with bonsai as a bonsai professional that hobbyists do not have.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Yeah.
So given that my livelihood for a portion of my life, say a quarter of my life so far, has been directly related to bonsai, I can look at a tree and appreciate it. And if it is very rare, I appreciate it as bonsai art.
Yeah.
Like this tree right here is a bonsai, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it is not a great one yet. And so it doesn't have the same value to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I take a loss, like I lost a $15,000 tree once because the person that I hired did not water my trees for 3 months while I was in Japan.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. So that particular winter, I lost roughly $80,000 worth of bonsai retail value.
Yeah.
Right? So I've also lost an entire tropical and orchid, rare cacti, ethnobotanical plant collection all at once in a day.
Oh my God.
As a greenhouse grower. So one 10 cent fuse in a Modine heater for my, I had a $10,000 greenhouse that I built for Samara Farms, which is a nursery I used to manage. I helped build that place and then they let me put my bonsai there, right? So one 10 cent fuse fails and I lose a decade worth of work.
Wow.
So bonsai makes you tough.
Yeah.
And if you're not resilient, you'll probably not make it as a long-term bonsai host.
Right.
Because the learning curve is very high to learn about art appreciation, ceramics, horticulture, aesthetics, all these things, you know, are combined in bonsai. And so it takes a special type of person to be interested in it and pursue it as a hobbyist, because they are kind of feeling around, right? They don't really know what's going on. So it takes a lot of hands-on work too. It's kind of a blood sport. Bonsai are often not very light. Big bonsai weigh 100 pounds.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting art form.
For sure. Yeah, I know. We met at a, I think we might have known each other beforehand, but we really talked for the first time at a music festival that you had been hired at, because they were like, we want to put your bonsai all over.
Right.
And I just think that's so cool that people just want to hire you to bring your work out, you know?
It was super fun.
Yeah, yeah. But I also know it's dangerous, you know, because it's like at one point, one of them was on like a subwoofer and it was
right. So my buddy Aaron designed the set for that event, mm-hmm. and it was made out of styrofoam that was painted green to look like a giant amphitheater. It was designed to look like Meru Temple. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Meru Temple has these cascading layers, and I had bonsai that I put on the top, and we did a bass test before the concert even went off, and we had them gaffer taped to the blocks. We had metal spikes in them, all this stuff, and we cranked the power up to 100% on the bass just to see what would happen, and they were fine, right? Well, they didn't tell me that they only keep the power at 70% on the speakers until the final night.
Oh.
So Charles the First comes on, rest in peace. He was one of my favorite acts that was coming that year. I was super excited.
Yeah, he passed shortly after that too.
He did. And we miss him. There was some very, very high moments in the show where the bass was so prolonged that it disrupted all the tape rigging that we had for the trees. And I had to watch the tree slowly migrate off the styrofoam block and almost fall like 60 feet, right? So I'm at my vendor booth selling bonsai and watching the show, and I go over to check on the trees just because I figured I would. And I see the tree hanging halfway off of the edge of the soundstage, teetering and jumping. So it jumped a foot this way and then 2 feet this way. So I sprint up the soundstage, go through Charles's legs while he doesn't miss a beat playing, and grab the tree as it's falling off of the soundstage, and then put it back and then go back through his legs. I've had a nervous breakdown because it wasn't my tree. Anyway, it was an intense experience, and I was glad to have bonsai on the main stage.
Yeah.
People got a lot of cool photos and got some exposure.
Yeah. Something I didn't realize before you is that there's a lot of bonsai masters here in the South, and it's like a pretty popular thing around here, right? Do you feel like it's mostly this region, or do you feel like I've just underestimated the interest in America in general?
Well, COVID changed a lot of things. It's an understatement of the decade, but as COVID lockdown occurred, everybody got stuck at home, right? And that's why houseplant sales went onto the stock market. Mm-hmm. People started hedge funding, you know, tropical plant labs in Florida.
Hedge funding.
Yeah, excuse me. I mean, for houseplants and bonsai, the spike in value because of COVID was a welcome change. Because what I've been doing my whole life is working with plants and understanding that people can benefit from actually remembering that, you know, they're a vital part of our existence, right? I mean, your podcast covers a lot of different useful plants, and we've been interacting with plants, you know, since for recorded history. So like when COVID happened, all the bonsai nerds got to stay home and work on their trees, right? And so bonsai got elevated in the United States and elsewhere. But it's an interesting thing to pursue as a hobby if you're bored and interested in caring for things. Like during that lockdown, I think that the numbers of young people, especially in bonsai, was exponential. So we're experiencing a surge like we had in the 1980s for bonsai as art in America. And the internet's really helped as well, of course, with spreading the information.
There's something really interesting about, like, James, you were kind of mentioning that it's like proliferating in the South specifically, because I definitely don't see as much of it in like New York. I see like the most present bonsai that I see are at like the New York Botanical Gardens, and they have like an incredible collection of bonsai.
Sure.
But regular people don't seem to have that. And it seems to be kind of reflective of like a pace of living almost. Like in the South, there is this slower pace of living that is contrasted to like a rushing style that exists in the Northeast.
Thank you for prompting me there. To answer your question directly, the South is a hidden reserve of talent. Okay. There's been talented artists here since forever. And people in the South aren't as loud about what they do, right? And one of the things about bonsai in the South is there are people who have done 6-year bonsai apprenticeships in Japan that live in Alabama and elsewhere in the South that didn't make it as a bonsai professional because of societal norms or whatever reason. Their personality wasn't geared towards being an instructor or a presence in the bonsai field. And those people are still here and they're still doing bonsai. Most of them are consultants because not everybody can get in front of a crowd and talk, right?
Right.
Nor do they care to, for that matter. One of my favorite bonsai professionals is a guy named Peter Warren. Mm-hmm. He studied astrophysics over in the UK, realized that wasn't for him, became a bonsai pro. And I asked him, what would make you like bonsai more? And he said, if people left me alone and just let me do bonsai, right? And didn't have to tap dance in front of a crowd of people, entertain them and all that. So that was a cool point for me to hear, because I believe the same thing. You know, being a bonsai instructor in the South requires me to travel greater distances than, say, if I live in Cincinnati. For about 8 of the 10 years I was doing bonsai, I didn't work with people in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. My closest customer was 5 hours away by car.
Wow.
But there are talented people in the South, and there's a lot of hobbyists who should be teaching at a professional level if they chose to in the South. Mm-hmm. But you can't really track down bonsai collections. We don't really want to be found. Like, I don't want to advertise where my bonsai are.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to be like, come on over and see where I keep all my shit.
Yeah. So, Well, like you said, it's an introspective art form,
yeah.
Right? And so it's like if you're taking an introspective art form like that, and then you have to make it public and, you know,
yeah,
extroverted, then I see why there's probably a lot of people who are like, I think I'm cool to just stick with my plants.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who were in the bonsai educational club scene, which are really social groups, mm-hmm, in most respects. But many of these bonsai clubs do have mentorship programs like ours in Nashville, the Nashville Bonsai Society. They do a mentorship program, Bonsai 101, and it creates 8 to 10 people a year who have a good bonsai baseline, and then they are capable of talking to these enthusiastic beginners and helping them.
Oh, yeah.
So that kind of stuff has been really helpful.
Yeah.
It's just interesting, like, describing that, because it's this very spiritual process of connecting to these plants and working in this introspective, meditative way, and, like, the communities around it are very esoteric, very similar to initiatory processes within spiritual groups, like this apprenticeship process and this mentorship process.
Okay, I would agree with that.
Yeah, right? And I think it's really interesting how this kind of like really quiet, introspective communal activity evokes this similar kind of like fractal pattern, to kind of even use the language of roots and branches, that it like mirrors itself in all of these different aspects and facets. And bonsai is like one path, like some people might take hallucinogens and like meditation and like being a monk or being spiritual person in that way down this path, and bonsai just seems to be the path that it has manifested for you and other individuals like that. So I just found that to be a very interesting parallel, I think, especially given the context of the show that we're in.
Yeah, I think if you took hallucinogenics in a regimented form and did bonsai, you could be better at it.
How so?
Well, I'm going to use psilocybin as an example. Mm-hmm. Okay, so when I took psilocybin in my past, when I was in college and since then, either in micro form or as an actual experience that I heard for, I would often prefer to be in nature, right? Because I feel more comfortable there. Definitely outside, if not in an actual natural environment. So like if you're going to look at a bonsai tree and observe it intently and figure out how you're going to make this a better bonsai while also not making it look contrived and like a square or, you know, a Charlie Brown looking Christmas tree that's half dead, I would say that taking psilocybin and reflecting on your interaction with plant would cause you to be a bit more careful and maybe more appreciative of its existence instead of just doing shit.
Yeah.
Right. So like, most excited beginners cut off a bunch of branches and they send me a picture. They're like, look what I did. And I'm like, yeah, I see that.
Like, you certainly did something.
Yeah, you certainly did something there. Yeah. And I have to be very supportive. And I did the same thing myself as a hobbyist, right? But having the influence of psychedelics, for example, on your bonsai practices would probably cause you to slow down and consider what you're doing a little more. And also, I feel like psilocybin helps you appreciate nature. That's an opinion. There's no science on it.
But it's a shared opinion.
I'd agree with that, too.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think that I would have my approach to gardening and bonsai if I hadn't taken psychedelics in my earlier years.
Oh, you think that was instrumental?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I think it blasted open some parts of my mind that weren't accessible in a way that was constructive in certain situations. I had negative experiences with psychedelics as well early on, and generally it's because I took way too many, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
Yeah.
And all we had was Arrowwood.org, which was largely speculative, I think.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking at all these ethnobotanical experiences and these cultural experiences from around the world, wanting to try them and not having good information.
Yeah.
So I think y'all are helping with
that. Well, thank you. It's interesting that psychedelics helped you kind of decide to go down this plant pathway, but you went largely down a path that didn't involve psychoactive plants. And I think that that's really cool, because a lot of people, you know, they try psychedelics and they say like, you know, I feel closer to nature, so I need to go to an ayahuasca retreat in South America or something like that, instead of I need to go and apprentice in Osaka for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think people who do those types of retreats and go to a geographical change are really going on a badass trip and experiencing that culture. And it's not just the ayahuasca that they're doing, it's they're soaking in something else.
Yeah.
But everybody's different about that.
Like, yeah, at least ideally.
Yeah. I mean, I would consider my experience in Japan to be a much higher experience than taking some sort of plant-based hallucinogen to expand my consciousness, because I was absorbing Japanese culture at an alarmingly fast rate.
Yeah.
You know, I was enculturating while not being able to talk to people or having my opinion heard. I was basically always wrong. So I was getting browbeaten, you know, psychologically while also trying to do something that's supposed to be relaxing. It's an interesting experience.
Yeah. No, I love that. What is it about plants for you? You've talked a little bit about what led you into the career. Mm-hmm. What is it about plants that keeps you in it? What's your passion?
For me, it's with bonsai in particular, it'll never be boring. Yeah. Bonsai get better with age. You get better with age. And as a career path, you get more expensive as a bonsai instructor, the whiter your hair is and the longer you've been doing it. So you've been doing bonsai 50 years, you can name your price.
Yeah.
You are the guru, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then the term bonsai master is often thrown around, but there are very few of them, mm-hmm. including bonsai professionals in the American and international community. There are people who are really good at bonsai, and there are people that are just good enough to get by.
Yeah.
And there's both. And aspiring to be what's called a plantsman, which is what I am. A plantsman has a broad scope of all aspects of horticulture. So they study mm-hmm. South African plants. They study bioluminescent algae. They're interested in all of it.
Yeah.
And they're knowledgeable about a lot of it. So that was kind of my goal, and I didn't realize it in college. Mm-hmm. And one of my professors, Dr. Armitage, called me out on it. Because it might have been subconscious, actually. And I didn't even know really what a plants person or plantsman was. But like, that's what I ended up pursuing, right? Mm-hmm. It was all aspects of horticulture. And for me, being able to do all these different things allows me to never really be bored. Mm-hmm. It's like a rabbit hole that's endless. And that's just if I did Japanese maple bonsai the rest of my life, right? Mm-hmm. So imagine the complexity of taking every species on the planet that's suitable for bonsai,
yeah.
and then pursuing that. It's like, this is going to be fun forever.
Yeah, no, it's awesome.
What sort of plants are suitable for bonsai? Like, what makes it suitable or unsuitable?
It's a good question. The genetics of this variety of Japanese maple were selected from a batch of seedlings that had smaller leaves than the ones around. And okay. so part of it is genetic variability that causes the dwarfing of plants, or the ones that naturally stay small or grow slower, often make for more desirable bonsai instead of, say, a sycamore seedling that has a natural leaf that's, you know, the size of a basketball. And while it is possible to make bonsai out of sycamore trees, they have to be of a certain height range to even be possible, right? And so what we do is we find species like junipers that can be made into any size. And then those are usually the most desirable. But traditionally, pine trees, this is a pine tree that's native to China, and I believe Ria in Japan. And it's used for I'm going to call it the Chinese style of bonsai, which is often known as pinjing. So they may have used this for their version of bonsai. And they chose it because it had desirable characteristics, and it also was in oftentimes culturally important. So a lot of the species that we use for bonsai that are from India are medicinal plants. And those medicinal plants were cared for in containers and they moved around with, right? And so they were like Indian bonsai, if you want to call it that.
What kind of plants are they?
Like pomegranate, especially the twisted trunk pomegranate. In certain cultures, you know, bamboo is used to make bonsai miniature forests, and that's sort of a symbol of water in summer. And so a lot of the stuff in Asia and the influences on the species chosen might have actually been deeply cultural before they ever became a subject matter. Here, we use native species like elm trees and maples that are easy to collect. And so part of the reason that species are or are not used for bonsai is if you can yank them out of the ground or not. Mm-hmm.
Fair
enough. Can you keep it in a pot and it be happy? Some plants just don't like that. Some plants enjoy it, and Japanese maples are one of those.
Mm. Are there any psychoactive plants that you could make as a bonsai?
Certainly. I was asked to make kratom bonsai for somebody, and I have a love for all ethnobotanical plants of all kinds. I like them all, every plant. I have no, you know, favorites when it would come to that kind of thing. But kratom bonsai and perpetuating that, I had a conflict with, and I actually didn't do it because I don't like to make kratom that accessible. I think it should be used responsibly and not be put in gas stations, personally.
Yeah.
Just me. I don't want to have a hyper-concentrated tincture of 8,000 milligrams of kratom available to me. Like, I don't want that, and I don't think other people should either. But that kratom bonsai project, the guy already had some other plants, kind of like cloning cannabis. He had dwarfed, compact kratom plants, and he wanted me to wire them, make them into bonsai. And that's totally feasible. You could make a cannabis bonsai, and people do. Problem is you cannot move them. They're still viable plant matter. And I actually looked into talking with Perfect Plant. Shout out, you know. I was talking with the Perfect Plant owners, and I was like, look, we got to figure out a way to do this. I will make them for you. Mm-hmm. Little cannabis trees covered with nugs, and let's sell them. Problem is when they're alive, you can't transport them without a license. Mm-hmm. I found some ways around that recently. If you have events at a grow facility where it's inspected, you could have 1,000 cannabis bonsai.
Oh, nice.
Everywhere. You have a million of them, right? But they can't leave unless their root system's been detached and they've started dying. Once they're no longer viable plant matter, you could theoretically have a cannabis bonsai.
What about just like a hemp bonsai then? So it looks like you get the art form of the plant, but it's not going to produce any nugs, a lot lighter legal status, that sort of stuff.
It depends on what state you're in and how enlightened our government becomes on the fact that cannabis is everywhere.
Yeah.
It's already here. It's covering the country.
Not very enlightened here in Tennessee. Yeah.
I think more enlightened than some places. But yeah, we're not really there yet, which is hilarious considering most of the cannabis was produced in Kentucky and Tennessee for a very long time. Mm-hmm. Kentucky used to be covered in cannabis. It's nice that they're going medicinal in the next year or two, from what I understand. You could grow a hemp bonsai, but depending on its sun and light exposure and the nutrients you gave it and how happy it was, it could be considered a hot plant based on Tennessee standards, for example, whatever stupid number it is, like 0.03% THC. Yeah. I mean, it would be possible, but if you had a hemp bonsai in your backyard and somebody saw it, they would think that you were cultivating cannabis for consumption, right? So that's dumb. If you were in a legal state, I say go for it.
Yeah.
You know, make them. You can bend them when they're young. They don't bend well when they're older, but you could very easily make them. And there's actually books available at Perfect Plant on how to make some rudimentary ones. But if you wanted to make
a bonsai,
you would have to really give it some time and some experimentation, especially with the rooting of the plant so that the roots were uniform. And then you'd have to have what you do with every bonsai, which is some sort of intent at the startings, right? Mm. So if you, let's say you guys want to make one, you would have to bend it when it was a month or so old in order to achieve a shape that was maintainable in a small scale. Mm. That's the only hindrance for making any ethnobotanical or otherwise bonsais. You got to be able to know what you're going to do to that tree long term. And if you don't, you're going to be reacting.
What would be like, I know you got to use like the small pots to limit the root size. What's like an appropriate size if you wanted to make a cannabis bonsai? What would you go for?
You know, I guess it would depend on the scale. If you had an 18-inch tall bonsai, you would likely need about a 4 to 6 inch deep container vertically to contain it and maintain the amount of moisture and nutrient load that you would need to continuously prune and grow and prune and grow your cannabis plant, right? So you would need a reserve that was, say, the size of a little bit smaller than a basketball for an 18-inch tall cannabis plant that had a complex structure. Would you want to make a bigger one? You know, you'd probably need a container that was the size of a suitcase and in the shape of a suitcase too, so that the proportions of your plant and the container matched so that it became an actual art object instead of just a plant in a pot, right?
Yeah, where is that line?
That's an excellent question. The only rule that I ever heard in Japan from my teacher that he told me that was hard and fast was, if it looks bad, it's not okay. So it's like any other art.
That's a great rule.
Yeah, if it looks like shit, it's not okay, you know? If it looks great, it's okay.
Yeah.
It's like very, very Japanese language of the gut, you know?
Yeah, yeah, eye of the beholder.
I would say any container that looks aesthetically pleasing to the viewer is an acceptable size. But you're talking about a very fine line here, because who are you hanging out with, right? Mm-hmm. Are your friends astute? Are you in a crowd of educated people, or are you, you know, hanging out with some people who don't know what's going on? Because their opinion technically might not matter if it's not an educated one, right?
Yeah.
It's also your plant. So if you're making a cannabis bonsai and anybody says anything about it, it's really not important because it's yours.
Yeah.
And if you share it, though, you are opening yourself up for human nature to come in with constructive criticism and unwelcome opinions.
I guess so. Like, where's the difference between simply a potted plant and when does it become a bonsai specifically?
That's an excellent question. I'm going to give you my opinion on that, and it's not a popular
okay.
Hot bonsai takes.
Okay, so now we're going to go with, you know, something that's not necessarily universally appreciated. So the bonsai that we have here with us today, which you can't see if you're listening, are in an intermediate stage, meaning they're not highly refined bonsai. So for me, a bonsai is a bonsai when it's displayed in an aesthetically pleasing space that has intention, like a Japanese tea garden or a high-end
or Zen garden or something.
Yeah. So in a place that has been prepared for the purpose of showcasing these bonsai. Now, that could be in an ultra-modern rooftop bar on a glass pedestal in the middle of a pool, or it could be in the most traditional of Japanese-style tea houses that cost like $1 million to make, and it's 8x8 square feet.
Yeah.
But everything in it is accurate to Kyoto, right? Mm. Both of those places are suitable. But if the place isn't nice and it's set up to look kind of like a yard sale, then it's an epic failure, in my opinion. And even nice trees are not bonsai in that moment.
Mm.
It's like a snapshot, right? We're taking a picture in our mind of trees. So if the environment is not conducive for aesthetic appreciation, then I don't feel like any plant, no matter how old it is a bonsai. It's a bonsai when it's prepared to be showcased.
Yeah.
So it's more the presentation of it than the like cultivation methods.
Sure. And I think it might be important to note how bonsai was first displayed and what the backing is for that.
Mm.
Okay, so there's a place called the Silver Pavilion in Kyoto, and that's where the first tokonoma was made. And a tokonoma is the alcove that you often see in Japanese homes or in businesses where they have like a scroll or a flower vase or a viewing stone of some kind. And those tokonomas, the first one was built by the abdicated emperor. He went and decided to be a poet, and he built the Silver Pavilion. Well, in that, he built this tea room with an alcove, and that's where the first bonsai were formally displayed, as far as I know. And so that space is roughly 8 feet by 4 feet. It's 4 tatami mats is the metric. But just think like 6 to 8 feet wide, 2 to 3 feet, even 4 feet deep, and then a 10-foot tall sort of height. And in that space, you would put a minimalist, aesthetically pleasing art piece that showcased the season, or maybe it was like your kid's report card. I think that's a really vague example, but you would showcase your kid's art that they made, you know, their crayon drawing. You hang that up in there. And in your house, that would show what you were proud of.
Mm-hmm.
And when you had a tea ceremony, which is what bonsai is really rooted in, and most traditional Japanese art forms, it's tea ceremony. When you had a tea ceremony for your guest, you might display a tree that was seasonally appropriate for when you had the tea ceremony, generally the oncoming season. So you would display a Japanese maple in fall color, but if you were a badass bonsai appreciator, you would have a tree that got fall color early, and you would display that when your friend came over to highlight the upcoming season.
Mm.
And it would just sort of set the vibe for your event, right?
Mm.
You having tea, you might, maybe it's a business meeting, you know, whatever. And so bonsais are traditionally displayed within that parameter, which in the United States is a traditional folding table. That's the actual amount of space you'd need for a bonsai display, but most people put them in a much smaller and confined space.
It's so fascinating that like the culmination of what bonsai has become now is the culmination of just like thousands upon thousands of years of people figuring it out and learning from each other about how to properly display it, how to properly cultivate it. And it's so much more than people think of it as when they just go buy a little yard sale bonsai from some street vendor market.
Yeah, it's really both. It can be whatever you want it to be.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think of the plant when they think of bonsai. And I think that was one of the first things that I learned about it that made me have a newfound respect for it, is that it's really more about the environment. Mm. And like the plant is obviously a major part of that. But like in this pot, you've got a beautiful ceramic that it's in. It's surrounded by moss. You've got these different environmental features for it. Mm-hmm. And then going to the extreme of that would be the environment surrounding it outside of the pot, you know, and where you're placing it. So I totally see where you're coming from there. That makes sense.
Have you ever seen like a ayahuasca bonsai or something like that? Is that possible?
You can make a bonsai out of any plant, end of line. Any plant can be made into a bonsai, because the derivative term for bonsai, the two kanji that create the word bonsai, which is pronounced like bone, like your human bone, and sai, like, so bonsai is how you're supposed to say it. Mm-hmm. I happen to be from the South. I say bonsai. So if you had an ayahuasca vine and you wanted to make it into a bonsai shape, it would be theoretically possible. Mm. I've never done it, but I'm totally willing to try. Mm. There are a lot of species of vining plants that can be made successfully and have been made into bonsai. So anything is theoretically possible.
Yeah, we've brought up Datura and other like vine plants like that in the last few episodes too, that I think would be really beautiful with the flowers that those make too. But
sure.
I wanted to talk about that too, because something that I find really wild about bonsai is when people take flowering plants or fruiting plants and essentially prune it to where it'll all go into just a few different flowers or fruit.
Sure.
Can you talk a little bit about what that does to those flowers in the fruit? Are they just the same, or is it?
Yes. Thank you. That's a very good question. So the only thing that can't change on a plant is the flower size. Mm. Flowers are always going to be the same size. Mm-hmm. It's also how we ID plants taxonomically, is usually the flower morphology is always the same for a species. Now we use genetic sequencing, which has disrupted the botanical world. But to answer your question, the fruit size can be adapted based on the amount of nutrients, water, and sunlight that's available. But generally speaking, we're going to choose plants that have fruit that is in the scale of bonsai subject matter that we're making. Mm-hmm. So if we're trying to make a tree that's, say, 2 feet tall, we don't want to use an actual pomegranate that has a fruit the size of a grapefruit.
Yeah, weigh it down.
However, there are bonsai nerds that put microscopic bonsai together that are, say, the size of a golf ball for the container, but they want to have a full-size apple, but just one apple. And so they have to prop the plant up because it's got one real apple on it.
Yeah.
And that's a horticultural accomplishment, which is actually a major part of bonsai.
Yeah.
Because think about it. If you're doing bonsai at a high level, you're allowed to talk some shit. Like you've gotten something that's taken a few decades and you can prove it.
Yeah.
You can be like, here's my tree, right? But doing those types of horticultural accomplishments is an aspect and a subgenre of bonsai internationally. It's like, can you make a tree that's a pyramid shape that's 8 inches tall and 8 inches wide? Mm-hmm. Well, you can. It just takes 10 times as long. So, but the fruit size is very important in terms of what you're choosing to pursue as bonsai. However, you can graft, say, a crabapple branch with microscopic fruit the size of your fingernail onto a regular apple tree that you dug up out of an orchard.
Mm.
So horticulturally, it's possible to change the genetics of the branching that you promote.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And many bonsai are made that way.
But why bother doing that if you could just bonsai the crabapple to begin with? I guess just to have a fruit on this specific area, I guess, or?
Well, to go back to ethnobotanical plants, certain ethnobotanical plants are grafted onto the seedlings of a parent plant in the same group. For example, let's say you've got a cannabis plant that auto flowers at 6 inches tall, and it never gets over 6 inches tall. If you had a root system for a fiber hemp plant that wanted to get 20 feet tall and you grafted those two together, you get the resilience of the root system and then you get the genetic behavior. It presents as the autoflowering plant, but it's got a supercharged root system that's exponentially more efficient.
Right.
With bonsai, we're often doing that. So we take a wild collected tree trunk from a pine tree from Western North America. Then we get the Japanese white pine, which is Pinus parviflora. That's the tiny form from Japan. And then we connect them somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then now you've got a next level bonsai because you have the characteristics that you want, and you've engineered that.
Yeah.
We've mentioned a lot like the Japanese history and tradition of bonsai. Is there anywhere else in the world that this tradition like developed organically, or is it pretty isolated to Japan?
So a lot of the research that's gone into the origins of bonsai has said that it came from China and potentially India and also what's now Korea through the conveyance of medicinal plants with the root system. So did you watch Waterworld?
Waterworld.
Remember that one?
No, I don't think I saw
it. So he had a tomato bush on his catamaran, and that's what
the old like apocalyptic movie, right?
Yeah. So full post-apocalypse, the world's flooded.
Yeah.
People are transporting their plants in little pots as they migrate. And a lot of people think that bonsai's influences from India in particular may have come with the transmission of Buddhism and medicinal plants north and northeast of India. So go through the Himalayas, cross China, pick up a couple of things, and then go to Japan, right? And so the containers that are often used were not bonsai pots. Mm-hmm. They were other containers or vessels that were used because they were old, embodied something cool, right? So are there other types of what I'm calling bonsai, which is the Japanese term for sure? In Vietnam, Sri Lanka, Southeast Asia, India, they all have their own styles. One of them is called Hannobo. And then in China, there were probably 100 or more schools of Penjing or Pensai. Mm-hmm. And so Japan didn't create this. They imported a lot of things from China, and including their garden styles and many other things. They also brought artists in to do stuff and commission containers later on for bonsai from China. But I believe that this sort of conveyance of plants in a vessel is potentially universal. I mean, the Chavin culture before the Inca might have had bonsai. We have no idea.
Yeah.
Like, how do you, I see a Nazca line of a bonsai, I'd say that they had it too, but you know.
Yeah, you're probably not going to find fossil records, right? Like, the trees just die.
Sure.
Yeah, totally makes sense that it could have been elsewhere. That's really interesting, though, that a lot of it got imported into Japan. How long ago did that become like a pretty firm Japanese practice?
I would say during the Muromachi period, bonsai really came up to a higher level, as did all other traditional Japanese art forms that stem from tea ceremony. So during that period of cultural refinement, and you know, they weren't killing each other like the Oni no Ran, the big Japanese civil war, bonsai requires peace in a weird way and in a good way. Like, a lot of bonsai died, for example, during World War II because there was no water for the trees. You have an earthquake and your water systems break. That's another reason a bunch of bonsai have died. But most of what we consider, I'm going to use the word classical bonsai, was generated from, say, the Muromachi period to the Edo period. Because bonsai trees didn't always look like they do now. They used to be a lot more sparse and a lot more unhealthy, actually. And it's only since, say, the 70s or 60s that even in Japan, the plant healthcare systems to do these bonsai at the high level evolved. And that was because of a spike called the bonsai boom. So bonsai went from being an old man's hobby that a bunch of people did by themselves to becoming wildly popular in Japanese culture. And that boom then transitioned here. And that wave of interest and advancement and information sharing caused it to become more popular here in the 80s.
Yeah. Did you have to learn a lot about tea as well?
Did I have to? No. Did
no.
I? Definitely. So I want to have a traditional Japanese tea shop in Nashville as soon as possible.
Oh, awesome.
And I deeply, deeply miss Highgarden because they had Gyokuro tea, for example. I don't know if you've ever had it, but it'll change your senses. It'll affect your perception of your environment just from the tea leaves and the way that they're created.
Wow.
So I studied tea as much as possible while I was there. And my teacher's father and mother studied tea ceremony at one of the famous two schools in Kyoto. And they taught me a little.
Yeah.
I don't claim to be like a tea master at all.
No, yeah.
I do know enough to be very dangerous about tea ceremony and the history behind it, but I am not a tea master.
Yeah.
Right? I'm a consumer.
No, it's so interesting. I read some, I think it was like a pretty old Japanese saying that I don't remember who said it. But anyways, the saying said something like, 3 cups of coffee makes my stomach upset, but 100 cups of tea makes my mind happy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. So one of my biggest influences is actually a book called The Book of Tea. And it was written in like 1904. And I can send you, and maybe we can make it available to your listeners, the PDF, which is very small. I've probably given it to 3,000 people via text message.
Oh, yeah. We can include that in the bio for sure.
Hell yeah. So that book is one of the best and most concise opinions on Eastern and Western culture and why we don't understand each other. It also covers the history of tea and about 100 other things. And every time I read an excerpt from it, it makes me a better writer.
Yeah.
Because this guy wrote this in like 1904, 1906 as his second language. He had to learn how to read and write in English before he wrote. And it's a very powerful book. But it covers the history of tea as well well as why, as again, like I said, why we don't understand each other.
Yeah.
East and West, that is.
Yeah.
Speaking of influences, like you said that this is a, like obviously a burgeoning practice for a lot of people in the wake of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't have the means, the resources, the ability to do an apprenticeship in Japan and like do it follow the traditional way. For someone who wants to get into this, or someone who wants to do it in a way that kind of respects that tradition and works with that tradition, are there any resources or people that you think are doing a great job of this kind of education?
Oh, definitely. So I would say there's probably about 20 people in America that do bonsai at a very high level and teach that aren't doing it for just themselves. I used to be one of those people. I don't travel to teach very much anymore just because of the wear and tear that it causes on your mind and body, mm-hmm. which is a lot. But there's Bjorn Bjørholm, who got me my apprenticeship, owns ASEAN, and he is based up until, I think, this coming spring in just outside of Nashville. So Bjorn is one who's been raising the quality standards and the appreciation, most importantly, what makes bonsai good. I would say that there are many other people in the Pacific Northwest, including Ryan Neal, Michael Hagedorn, and a lot of hobbyists that have blogs. There's a number of people in California that are doing a great job. And not all these people are teachers. Some of the most influential people for education, in my opinion, in bonsai are passionate hobbyists mm-hmm. who generate content for beginners, for example. If I did another beginner workshop where I taught people the start of bonsai, that would make me very unhappy. Like I did it, I've done 1,000 of them. And I feel like my purpose is now to go and transmit something that's a little bit higher level, mm-hmm. right? Have a bigger ripple effect. The beginners are covered with the 100 bonsai books that are in circulation since the 50s and all of the YouTube stuff that's out there. There are people who are hobbyists that are quietly changing the paradigm without meaning to, which are my favorite, right? They just exist. They just do what they're doing, and their presence on social media is changing things. So I would say that bonsai professionals are not all teachers. And the ones that are teachers and that are passionate about sharing this and aren't burnt out on it, because there's not a lot of money in bonsai unless you make them and sell them or collect wild trees. Most of the money in bonsai is made by the middlemen who market these products and sell them, right? And there's a lot of good people in bonsai. Like I can't cover it all now, but I would say that Bjorn, Ryan, Michael Hagedorn, and a guy named Boone Manitakivipart in California have had the most profound influence in recent years through social media and the internet and also in person. And they've all trained in Japan. So there's a unifying factor that most bonsai professionals don't like to talk about, which is, hey, did you actually go to art school for this? Like, did yeah. you get taught by somebody, or do you just like bonsai and have enough money to function mm-hmm. in this realm and not go broke because yeah. you have a trust, right? Like
yeah.
Bonsai requires patronage, whether it's your own or otherwise. And me included, I had patrons. So when I went to Japan, I had people backing me, right? Mm-hmm. And in America, as a teacher, that's required as you're a teacher too, because the traditional, and I am making a point here, I promise. The people that are most influential in America had a really savvy AV guy. They had somebody that told them, hey, you socially awkward plant nerd, you need somebody to make videos of you, and I'm going to sell them for you. And that helps too, because we can't do it all. So most everybody that's been successful in transmitting their passion for bonsai has had patronage. And the traditional Japanese model is exactly the opposite of here. And I'll explain. In America, bonsai hobbyists low-key want to become bonsai pros. So if you're passionate about bonsai and you want to achieve a high level of bonsai excellence, you basically have to figure it out, make them yourself, and then die. Right? Like that's the MO for many bonsai hobbyists in America, even if they don't realize it because we're American, right? So being pioneers and being people who go after our own thing to validate our, you know, accomplishments, we don't treat it the way they do in Japan. In Japan, they have patrons and they say, hey, I don't know shit about this, but I really like good bonsai. Sell me a Van Gogh. Sell me a Japanese white pine Van Gogh. I'm going to drop it off here. It's going to live at your nursery. And occasionally, because I'm a classy, badass person, I'm going to have you deliver it to my house when I have a party.
Mm.
And my visitors are going to see it for a night. And then I'm going to give it back to you so I don't screw it up. That's a patron, right?
Yeah.
And every service in Japan is a la carte. You need, it needs to be repotted, needs to be pruned, needs to be watered. When I'm on vacation, they paid the bonsai professionals for that. And they paid them way too much money,
mm-hmm.
right? They gave them $5,000 for a tree that should cost $2,000. Because mm-hmm. that money is what allows my teacher, for example, to sit at a bonsai nursery every single day of his life and monitor this Maserati collection of trees that sometimes cost $180,000, $400,000, $1 million. Mm-hmm. Think about like the rarest of rare paintings, like the Mona Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as bonsai are concerned, there are naturally occurring trees that were collected and then refined to an even higher level by badass bonsai people and then sustained for 300 years, right?
Yeah.
What's that worth? Well, nobody really knows, but you know, it's a lot.
So. Yeah.
It's like 6 generations, 7 generations of people caring for this one tree. tree. Like, that's crazy to think about.
Yeah.
Can you lease bonsais?
Definitely.
Like, say I wanted to have throw a dope ass party and I wanted bonsai, but I don't want to be paying yearly for someone to babysit.
What about layaway?
Layaway?
Yeah,
layaway. So I can say with the utmost certainty that I had a bonsai vending existence as a teacher as well on the road through the layaway program.
Oh yeah.
And so people's tastes don't always line up with their revenue, man.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody wanted a $900 tree, but they could only afford a $50 a month payment to me. When I was actively teaching and buying and selling trees every day, I would honor that.
That's awesome.
And I would say, okay, you're gonna send me $50 a month for the next 8 months. And I believe you. Here's your tree. And so that's definitely a thing. What was the first part of the question again?
Can you lease? Oh. Is there like a leasing?
Oh, right. So bonsai leasing is very popular in Japan, and my teacher made a portion of his revenue leasing trees to corporations like Daihatsu. So the Daihatsu car company had a tree in their lobby every day for the last 20 years, and they would be rotated out every 5 to 7 days so that the trees did not get sick from being in the almost zero humidity indoor environment that we like to live in.
Right.
So bonsai leasing is totally possible. I aspire to lease them to every cool thing that ever happened in Nashville, and it's actually really accessible that way because you get the tree dropped off. You have somebody monitor them. You have somebody take them away. And honestly, I feel like that's the future of bonsai. And I say that, haven't thought about this for a long time. Most people don't want to own a bonsai. They're incapable of caring for it. They don't have the space. They don't have the time. They don't want to screw it up. And so leasing of bonsai and the visitation of bonsai to a site, I think, is the best way to share it.
Mm.
It's also a good way to be classy and not have to do this every day.
Yeah.
So if you can appreciate bonsai and you were cool enough to think about it, then you should have them at your event. And they totally change the ambiance of a space. I just did a wedding for my chiropractor, Charlie Couts, which is the fine-tuned clinic. I'll plug him for sure.
Shout out.
He now has a bonsai that I gave him as a wedding present. Mm. And the first thing that we did for his jade plant was we went through the care and cultivation of the tree and when to call me.
Mm.
What constitutes an emergency for a bonsai, right?
Yeah.
This is important. When do you call somebody? Do you call them when your juniper is brown? No, it is now dead. You call them when it looks like you might not be doing something right.
Yeah, I think we've got to wrap up here soon, but I did want to still ask and then give everyone else a chance in case they have a question too. My last question that I want to know is, how many plants do you take care of on a daily basis?
So the short answer is I started right after I was introduced to bonsai in college. Within a month of learning about bonsai, I had acquired 600 different containerized plants that I either dug up myself or, you know,
this is
acquired.
Within a month? Wow.
Well, as a horticulture student, we had access to breeding programs and miles, like square miles of plants that were being mm-hmm. thrown away after they had taken the top 10 of the 10,000
for a
breeding program. So I had access to 500,000 azaleas, you know, stuff like that. Now I have roughly 20 trees that I care for. And now I'm outsourcing the long-term siting of bonsai to some greenhouse facilities in Nashville that I'll check on.
Mm-hmm.
I've had as many as 1,000 plants in my possession in the past. I think the stable number for anybody that's interested in doing it for a long time is 20 or less.
Yeah, it's interesting. Anybody else have anything?
I wanted to ask about palm tree bonsais. I've never seen it, and I've always wondered about it. Because, like, is it just that their leaves are too big for them to look good unless you grow, like, a large bonsai? Or, like, what's the reason why I can never find a small palm tree, like, in a bonsai?
So I've seen 2 palm tree bonsai in person in my life.
Mm-hmm.
One was from a very famous collector outside of Osaka, and my favorite bonsai collector, actually. He had a dwarf sago palm that was roughly 1 foot tall and 1 foot wide, and he found a pot from southern Japan that was like 100 years old that had a fish motif on it. So he was making a specific bonsai for a specific cultural region of Japan, and he had grown that dwarf sago palm for 40 years, and it was not very big. So it is possible to make a palm bonsai, especially with sago palm. They can grow in a confined space very well, and they don't need much water. I've never seen like a other type, like a banana palm or anything like that. It's not really a palm tree, but I think it is theoretically possible to emulate a palm tree shape with a plant that isn't a palm tree and looks like a microscopic palm tree. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Maybe acacia or something?
Yeah, totally. The only bonsai that I've ever made to look like palm trees, I use Nandina, which is called Heavenly Bamboo or Nandina Domestic. So I have done that actually for my buddy's party spot. He wanted a beach-looking bonsai, and so I made him some Nandina. In a palm tree.
That's really cool. Out of bamboo. That makes sense. Yeah.
I don't have any questions. I'm just like, I feel like I have ascended. I feel like I have been spending the last like hour and a half just taking deep breaths, and it's been yoga. Great.
Where can people find you? Where can people become your patron?
So you can find me on Instagram at Plant X Alchemy, and I'm about to start a podcast myself after we get the proper amount of funding, and that'll be the Plant Alchemy podcast. So stay tuned for that. It'll
is there
probably
be an X in that one, or
not sure yet. We're trying to Plant Alchemy as a phrase is very popular.
Totally,
so
yeah.
Plant X Alchemy.
No kidding.
And then plantxalchemy.com is my website, but you can definitely find me easiest on Instagram and what I'm up to now. Thank you for having me on this, and thank you to the Garden Family Studio for hosting this.
Yeah, if you're watching the video, that's how we got this dope-ass studio, so thanks to them.
And thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, of course, Owen. I'm so happy. I'm always happy to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. This was great.
Thanks, Owen.
Thanks.
And that's another episode of the Trip Sitter Podcast. Make sure to check out Owen's website and Instagram, PlantX Alchemy, to check out more of his work and see what he's doing now. Trip Sitter is supported by our fans. If you dig the work we do and want to help support us to keep doing it, head over to tripsitter.substack.com and become a premium subscriber to help support us. Want to show your support but can't do the monetary commitment? Review, like, and share this podcast. It really does help boost our listenership. This episode was co-hosted by J. Gordon Curtis, Justin Cook, and Rowan Zioli. The podcast is edited by J. Gordon Curtis with help from Ronilo Villamore. Thanks, Ronilo. J. Gordon Curtis is also the producer of the podcast. As always, we want to end with a reminder. There's no such thing as a bad drug. They're just chemicals, natural or unnatural, that exist within our world. It's our relationship with them and how we interact with them that makes the difference. Until next time, have a safe trip.